Hi, Valerie.
Hi, Lama. How are you?
I will practice the profound Mahayana Dharma by way of study, contemplation, and meditation. Hi, Sue. If you're able to hear, can you hear us? You can just wave your hand. Great. Okay. Welcome. Sue Gately from Maine or New Hampshire. I think Maine. Okay. So if anybody has any questions or comments before we do the meditation, just signal me or unmute. And if not, we will go ahead with the meditation. Kathy, can you hear okay? Oh, you're muted. So you'll just let me know if you need any.
Yeah.
Okay. So we're going to begin by checking in with our posture. Just our presence in the present moment in our body. So just making sure the spine is straight, everything's grounded and stable and secure, and our body is relaxed. And now we bring our mind to a state of relaxation as well by letting go of whatever thoughts we may be caught up in, whatever tensions, anxieties, thoughts, and let our attention drop gently into the feeling of being in our body, like what our body feels like from the feet grounded on the floor the feet grounded on the floor, the hands grounded on the thighs or knees or however we are placing them, the temperature, just not analyzing or making thoughts about it, but just tuning in with what it feels like in our body to be in this present moment of awareness. And if any thoughts arise, we simply welcome them and let them go, not getting caught up in them. Or if we do, we just let them go when we realize it. Just bringing the body and the mind into a state of rest, alert, relaxed rest. And within this state, we very briefly bring the four reminders to mind. Remembering and appreciating the precious human existence, great opportunity we have in this lifetime. Impermanence and death, that it will end and could end any time. The law of karma, which we studied last week, that our fate is determined by our own actions, whether we create future happiness through helpful actions, create future suffering through harmful actions, or create liberation, which is the topic today. It's up to us. And then the suffering of samsara, which is also today's topic. That there's no reliable happiness anywhere in confused existence. Therefore, we must use this life to free ourselves and others from it. Exactly the same thought as verse 9. Well, verse 9 and 10, because others are included. So now we'll just follow the breath for just a moment or two in this relaxed, straight posture. With our mind relaxed and alert. Noticing each breath coming and going, but also maintaining a sense of vast, open awareness. And within this the state of mental alertness and relaxation. We will cultivate ultimate bodhicitta or wisdom simply by letting our mind rest for a moment in the vastness and limitlessness of our awareness. Completely open, completely receptive, not fixating on anything. Just completely open from moment to moment, letting go of everything as it arises. And now within this state of being in touch with our Buddha nature, we will do taking and sending, which cultivates love and compassion, relative bodhicitta. And we'll begin today by, this is going to relate to verse 8 and verse 9, by bringing to mind first someone we know who is suffering, like has actual suffering. One person, a group of people, everybody in eastern Texas and Louisiana who's flooded, who's having lost their home, their possessions, pets, sometimes people, their car, everything gone, not knowing what's going to happen next, really feeling the suffering, feeling with them their suffering and breathing it in. With the aspiration to take it away from them and dissolve it in our own vast Buddha nature and our heart center. And breathing out to them, comfort, relief, basic needs met, peace, camaraderie, whatever will help. Just coming back to a vivid sense of who we're praying for, taking and sending for it whenever our mind starts to wander. Breathing in all of their suffering, all of their loss. Breathing out whatever they need. And now, expanding our visualization, our intention to include all beings, all the rest of beings who are not suffering anything acutely in this moment, but who, you know, along with ourselves, insofar as we're not suffering anything intensely at this moment, all of us who are experiencing basically good conditions in samsara right now, we may basically have our health even though we have issues. We have basically everything we need. We have a roof. We have a house that's not flooded. We have food. We have friends. Possibly we have something to celebrate. And breathing in our suffering, which is the suffering of change, of not realizing that this suffering is fleeting. And we'll turn to outright suffering at some point. So the suffering of all beings, all sentient beings throughout limitless space, whether they know they're suffering in this moment or whether they're really not aware of suffering in this moment. Understanding that it's all suffering in some sense. So breathing it in, letting it dissolve, breathing out the antidote, relaxation, comfort, peace, and awakening. Awakening to our state of being imprisoned in samsara, whether we're suffering in this moment or not so much suffering in this moment. Breathing in this feeling of claustrophobia, perhaps, of realizing that we're trapped. And breathing in our sense of obliviousness, of not realizing it when things are going well. Breathing out the antidote, which is being awake. And the antidote, which is realizing the possibility of liberating ourselves and others. Not losing track of the people in Houston and Louisiana or anyone else that we know is suffering, but also including everyone else, even the God's realms. Touching in again with open awareness, even as we do this taking and sending. Touching in with the sense of freedom that is our true nature. Sharing that as we breathe out. And now letting go of the visualization, thinking first that everyone is free from suffering, including ourselves. Everyone is filled with true happiness and with realization of their Buddha nature, which is the awakening of a Buddha. And then letting go of all conceptuality and just following the breath or resting in open awareness. And now, as much as possible without losing touch with open awareness or with love and compassion, bringing ourselves back to the present moment, ready to direct our attention towards study and contemplation. All right, does anybody have any questions or comments before we go on to chant the verses together? I'm going to bring up the share screen. Okay, so we're just going to recite again, and you know, at some point we can recite the first seven verses as well. We can chant them, but today again we're going to just read through what each verse is until we get to verses 8 through 10. And there's a couple of words in red in verses 8 through 10, and those are words that I have updated. So I will have to change those on the blog as well at some point. So now turning our attention to study, right now this is study, to actually go over the practices we've studied and to chant the current verses. So the first practice of a bodhisattva is to study, contemplate, and meditate. The second practice, to leave my homeland. Third, to rely on solitude. Fourth, to let go of attachment to this lifetime. Fifth, to give up negative friends, friends who harm my practice. Sixth, to rely on spiritual friends. Seventh, to seek refuge in the three jewels. And then 8 through 10 being the beginning of the main teachings, the three levels of motivation for Dharma practice. We will chant all three, even though we are just on verse 9 today. The sufferings of the three lower realms, these states of mind so difficult to bear, according to the teachings of the sage, are the result of actions that cause harm. Therefore, even with my own life at stake, from harmful actions always to refrain, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. And that was number 8, to refrain from harm at all costs. Number 9 we'll chant 3 times because it's our verse today, to strive for unchanging freedom. Like drops of dew upon each blade of grass, the three realms' happiness evaporates. In contrast, the supreme and highest state of liberation doesn't ever change. To strive in all our efforts to be free, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. Like drops of dew upon each blade of grass, the three realms' happiness evaporates. In contrast, the supreme and highest state of liberation doesn't ever change. To strive in all our efforts to be free, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. Like drops of dew upon each blade of grass, the three realms' happiness evaporates. In contrast, the supreme and highest state of liberation doesn't ever change. To strive in all our efforts to be free, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. Let's take a moment to just let that sink in. You can read it over again if you need to, silently, or just rest in it. And then looking ahead to verse 10, the final stage of motivation to enter the Dharma path is to liberate all beings, not just oneself. My mother's each and every sentient being, since time without beginning cared for me. How can I be happy while they're suffering? I must get to work to set them free. To cultivate the mind of full awakening, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. Okay. Okay, so my plan today is to go on to verse 9, but I wanted first to read Pema Chodron's short commentary on verse 8. Bringing us back to this very foundational motivation to practice the Dharma, which is to escape suffering in this life and in future lifetimes. I'm going to read it, and then if anybody has any questions or comments about verse 8, we can talk about that, and otherwise we'll go on to verse 9. So verse 8, which she identified as karma, she says, this verse is about becoming aware of craving or desire, aggression or anger, and ignoring or ignorance. How our craving, aggression, and indifference projects a world. So here we are. So last week we talked both about the three realms, the three lower realms, the hells, the hungry ghosts, and the animals, like being literally like a place that we're taught that we could end up in our next life, and what the sufferings of those are, and the fact that being afraid of those is a big motivation to engage in Dharma practice. So we also talked about the psychological aspect of those, that these are states we can experience even in this lifetime. And that's what Pema Chodron is going to describe here or address, how that comes about. So she says, a person who lives in hell is one who is extremely angry all the time. Everything makes them angry. They project a world that is aggressive and hostile and are always fighting against the world, always attacking these outside projections rather than looking at their own mind. So perhaps you've known people like this. My mother, for example, fell into that category. Always angry, always easily upset, and she experienced the world as hostile. And in her later years, when she had dementia, she thought people actually kidnapped her and did terrible things to her. So how did that happen? How do we end up in that kind of a state? Hema Chodron says, it happened with all the previous moments, again and again and again, one strengthened that habit of anger, resulting in the feeling of living in a hostile world. Never interrupting the momentum or creating a gap in that seamless anger that seems to control us. So, you know, each time we get angry, each time we lose our temper, each time we're irritated and upset, it seems like a small thing, like, oh, it's, you know, all right, fine, I'm over it now. But each time we indulge it, either because we can't help it or because we just don't try, it reinforces that pattern and makes the world a little bit more hostile and our mind a little bit more in a hell realm. So what can we do to interrupt the momentum? She said, we have to begin to look at what we're doing right now. The advice is first, become conscious of what you're doing. So we have to notice. We just have to notice that pattern of anger and or desire or indifference, shutting things out, escaping, whatever, whichever thing manifests the most for us. We have to really start to notice it, to catch it. And it's very frustrating in that first stage because we catch it. So we're aware of it and it makes us even more uncomfortable. We can't make it stop. We can't always make it stop, but it's really important to be aware of it. That is the first step. It could go on for a long time that way, but it's really important to do it. So she said, we have to begin to look at what we're doing right now. The advice is first become conscious of what you're doing and then see what kind of response you're getting from the outside. Do people treat you like you have a chip on your shoulder? Are they very careful around you? You might be projecting something even when you don't feel it. So then you perceive that projecting back at you, and it feels like the world is a hostile place. So she says, self-reflection allows you to begin to become aware of your emotions, how your body feels. How does our body feel when we're starting to get angry or we're starting to want something that maybe we can't have in that moment or shouldn't have in that moment? How is this emotion impacting you and causing you and others to suffer? Becoming aware again and again in open, compassionate awareness. And if Fanny were here, she'd be mentioning this, that it's not about judging ourselves harshly because this is happening. It's just about becoming aware of it and having compassion towards ourselves, just as we would try to have compassion towards someone coming at us aggressively as a Buddhist practitioner. We also have compassion for our own habitual patterns that we can't stop in this moment. So she says, yes, an open, compassionate awareness, not judging, but going from unconscious to conscious. That's what this process is. We are making our unconscious patterns conscious. Very uncomfortable place to be, just like when we first started meditating and it seemed like it made us have more thoughts. Like, I can't do this because it makes me like think so many thoughts, like my mind is so confused, but really we're just illuminating the way our mind is. And through that illumination, it can start to settle down. But right now, we may just be working at that cutting edge of noticing things as they arise. So she said, so I'm going to read that sentence again because it leads into the next sentence. Becoming aware again and again in open, compassionate awareness, not judging, but going from unconscious to conscious, that could describe the spiritual path overall. This is our work, basically. And that's why Gampopa and Trungpa Rinpoche tell us that for meditation to be effective, it has to have content. We have to be working with whatever our actual kleshas or mental afflictions are And to work with them, we have to know what they are. We have to be aware of them and see them as they're arising as much as we can. And that's our path. So she ends by saying, when we become aware, emotional obscurations don't blind us anymore, and we can see what is happening with other people. So we may experience other people differently too once we start to work with our own mind. So does anybody have any questions, comments, any thoughts to share on that or on anything about verse 8, refraining from harm at all costs in order to avoid our own suffering? So you can unmute yourself or signal me. And if there isn't anything, that's fine too. All right, then this verse is understood. And again, you know, to emphasize, to hammer it in, as we do, it's really important to have this level of motivation. You can't go straight to total Mahayana motivation, I'm going to become enlightened to save all beings. That piece has to be in there or we won't take it seriously. We won't work. If we don't feel that discomfort and that fear, you know, of where our habitual patterns are leading us, we really won't apply ourselves to practice. So we have to cultivate that. And, you know, and reading about the hell realms and the hungry ghost realms and all of that, that I find that actually really helpful. Reading about the psychological states, I find that really helpful. You may not, so you can approach it however works for you, but don't leave that piece out. Really think about that sometimes, the suffering of samsara, the Four Noble Truths. The first one begins, it's suffering. So we want to notice that, and we want to really generate the aspiration and the strong intention and the resolution to put an end to it. And right now, again, we're only working at our self level. Now, we can be secret Mahayana practitioners, even as we're studying this verse, but we want to put ourselves in that frame of mind of really focusing on my own suffering, which we sometimes gloss over. My own suffering. I am suffering now. Why am I suffering now? Oh, it must be something I did in the past. Really thinking about karma, really taking it seriously. This is the foundation of all other motivations. So if there are no comments or questions, and again, unmute yourself anytime or signal me anytime. We will have our pop quiz. Many of you may have already done it on the website. So let's take a moment. It's good to do this like every day even. So if it's repetitious, I have no problem with that. Four Noble Truths. Do we know what they are? Can we list them? I'm doing it too. Okay, I'll just reel them off. First one is that there is suffering. Suffering exists. Our experience is permeated by suffering, verse 8. Second one is suffering has a cause. That's the first glimmer of something positive. It's not random. It's not like I'm under a cloud, you know. It's like there's a reason for it. Third one is that it can come, because it has a cause, it can come to an end. We can eradicate suffering because it has a cause. And the fourth one is there is a path for eradicating the cause and thus bringing suffering to an end. So you could just, the simple list is just suffering, origination of suffering, cessation of suffering, and path. That's the list. That it would be good if we all had that off the top of our head and could explain that to somebody who asks us what's Buddhism about, because that's what Buddhism is about. That was the first teaching that the Buddha gave after he became awakened. And he first thought, nobody's going to get this, so I'm not going to teach. I'm just going to like go around in my awakened state. But then he was begged to teach by various of the gods, and he agreed to teach. And he said, well, there will be a few who don't have so much dust on their eyelids. Like they could maybe be able to open their eyes without the weight of like all that dust on them. And then he had disciples and people who actually did understand. And here we are today, like 2,600 years later. We're really glad he decided to teach. And it was the Four Noble Truths. second pop quiz is, what are the three types of suffering? We've all been on the path long enough now that we should be able to just say those. third one might be challenging to put into words, but we all know what it is. So the first one is suffering of suffering, like actually feels bad. Second one is the suffering of change, feels good, is going to feel bad, or is going to go away and not be there anymore. And the third one is called the all-pervasive suffering of conditioned existence. Conditioned existence means anything that comes together from causes and parts. It will fall apart. That's the four ends. Everything that's accumulated will disperse. Everything that's built will be ruined. Everyone who's born will die, and so forth. So that's the three kinds of suffering. And you can think of, if the third one is too much of a mouthful, like for you to get your brain around it, like on the spot, you could just think impermanence. I think impermanence is a pretty good stand-in for the third one. So we're all experiencing impermanence every second, whether we are aware of it or not. So tuning into that is like really understanding the third kind of suffering that we all experience all the time, whether things are going well or going badly. All right, so contemplation on verse 9, right. So on the website, I posted a contemplation, and I'd like to for all of us to think about it for a minute and possibly discuss it if anyone has anything to share. We had a really good discussion last week of the contemplation, which was what? In what ways do we harm others intentionally or unintentionally, and which of the 10 negative actions might be hard to avoid doing. We had a really great discussion on that last week, which I summarized very briefly in the post. So for this week, the question about this verse was, okay, well, first of all, the verse is like drops of dew upon each blade of grass, the three realms happiness evaporates. Sorry, Kathy, I might have, you might not have heard for a second there. In contrast, the supreme and highest state of liberation doesn't ever change. And here comes the zinger. To strive in all our efforts to be free. This is the way a bodhisattva trains. So like he really said all efforts. He really said that. I put it in italics on the website. To strive in all our efforts to be free. To turn all of our efforts, to direct all of our energy towards freeing ourselves. That's the instruction here. Now, we've had many instructions like that, like to study, contemplate, and meditate without distraction day and night. Can we really do that? Is that really literal? We discussed that with regard to a few of the verses. Like, does he mean this literally? And if he does mean it literally, how can we do that? And if he doesn't mean it literally, well, then why is he saying it that way? So is this possible? Is this possible? Let's think about that for a minute. What would it mean to direct all of our effort all the time towards freeing ourselves? Like, we're not even thinking about others yet, but just to get free ourselves of samsara. What would it take to make us want to do that? And could we do that? So that's the first question. Second question is like about our own lives, and you don't have to share personal things about this, but I think we all can ask ourselves, where am I on that scale, like right now, like from zero effort to all effort? Like, where am I on that spectrum? What do I like? What's the first thing I do or think of when I get up in the morning? How do I decide what to do all day? Like, if we have a job, then a big chunk of time is out of our control. Can we use that to free ourselves? Is it possible if we have a very demanding job, can we at the same time be freeing ourselves from samsara? That's a question to contemplate and to look for, you know, to look at whether that's true. And if it is true, if you could do it, how would you do it? But like, what kinds of short-term and long-term goals do we have right now? Like, is there something that we're saving up money to buy, or, you know, some big project that we want to complete? Does that interfere with our Dharma practice, with trying to free ourselves from samsara? Is it a distraction? And basically, how does my Dharma practice actually fit into my life? And I can speak from both sides of this, having been in 3-year retreat where it's forced, like you just do Dharma all the time or you flunk, to like, I'll get to it. But first I'm going to do this other thing. And then I'm going to meet that friend. And then, oh gosh, I got this TV show that is real. I really want to see. And like, it, the end of the day comes and you're too tired to do your Dharma practice. Like I have done that whole spectrum. So I sympathize with anyone who's having trouble fitting Dharma practice into their life. And if we do, if our life is really so jam-packed with things that we really have to do that we can't, you know, adjust in order to fit some formal practice in, how do we make the practice happen as we're busy? And I don't have answers for this. I mean, I have my own answers, but these are just questions I think we need to ask ourselves, because we need to motivate ourselves. You know, is suffering enough to motivate us to practice? Often it is. Like the suffering hits and you go, okay, I'm going to go do chimrezi now. You know, I need protection. I'm going to do Mahakala tonight because this bad thing is happening. I lost my train of thought again. There was something that was leading to, but you know, I think the point is made. So does anybody have anything that they would like to comment on or share about this? Like how do we accomplish this? How do we free ourselves from samsara when we're so darn busy? Yes, Chet, I will unmute you. Chet.
Hi, well, actually you said something, I think it was last week, about electronic diversions like the iPhone and being very conscious of that. So I took your advice and I put a picture of Buddha on my phone. And you know what's interesting is every time I pick it up, that's the very first thing I see. And it stops me in my path because I'll look at it and I'll go, oh, I think I'll just do like, you know, I'll Facebook or I'll do some Google search. And I look and go, well, maybe I don't really need to. Do I need to do that? Not really. Yeah. But it's been very helpful. And also when I get calls on it or text messages, it's the first thing I see. So it makes me, I start to reframe how I'm responding to the call or the text message as it comes in and going, do I need to text this person back? I don't know. Do I need to call them? You know, what's really important right now? So that's, I thought that was a great suggestion. So thanks for that one.
Well, that's good. It's working for me too. But again, you know, you could text the person back, but what it does is it makes you take refuge in that moment. It makes you remember refuge in that moment, even if you're going to go to the party, you know, or whatever it is you're going to do, which is fine. You know, you get to decide your whole life. You get to decide that. That's up to you. Nobody's judging. You know, this is just options. This is your options. We go in this direction or that direction or that direction. But I find it most useful that, like, maybe I have to take the call, but it made me think of the refuges. And I am fine. This Thich Nhat Hanh's mindfulness bell is now our iPhone or whatever phone we have. Okay, thanks for sharing that. Anybody else? I'm going to just unmute everybody. And okay, yeah, Dan, I'm unmuting everybody. And we're all unmuted.
I always just hang my mala next, like on my bed, actually. So first thing when I wake up in the morning, it's the first thing I see and I grab it. So
another method. That's great.
Yeah. And it's also the last thing I hang up before I go to sleep, or I usually do some manis right before bed and then put it away. So
great. That's a really useful thing. Like to remind yourself you could do some mantras or a little practice before you actually hit the sack.
Yeah. It kind of relaxes me too for bed.
Yeah. And reminding you when you wake up if it's the first thing you see. Nice. Yes, Susan.
I want to say, go back to, does all mean all? Okay. Right. And I choose to believe or trust that this practice is beneficial to anybody. Okay. So that means to me that there must be simple, ordinary techniques to be able to do it all the time, okay? And that, so in other words, you're not excluded if you have a busy life. You're not excluded if you have a corporate job. You're not excluded. In other words, there's ways and techniques. I don't have the answers so much as, but it goes back, doesn't it go back to when I'm washing the dishes, I am washing the dishes.
Yes. When
I'm on that phone call, whether it is a meeting or whatever it is, I'm on that phone call. I'm awake. I'm with it. I'm noticing my speech. So I think for me, it's notice when you're washing your hands, do that Thich Nhat Hanh, water comes from that whole four verse. So, to me, it's those little, I call them kind of tricks, but it brings us back to right now, and it doesn't matter so much what I'm doing.
Yeah, I think that's brilliant. I think that is the essence. I mean, I think we are being instructed to do formal practice. I think that's clear. Yeah. But I don't think we're being instructed to do formal practice every minute of the day. You know, even in monasteries, you can't do that. Somebody has to cook. So back to what Chet was saying, I think that it can function the same way. It's not necessarily reminding you not to engage in the thing, not to look at your phone, not to go on Facebook. Maybe you will go on Facebook. Maybe there's nothing wrong with that, but you can go on Facebook mindfully. You actually can, with awareness. So seeing that Buddha there could just bring you back. In fact, that's what Thich Nhat Hanh said. The bells of the mindfulness bell brings us back to ourself, which is our Buddha nature. So we don't have to necessarily alter our activity, although I still am going to keep hammering in the importance of setting aside some time every day to do formal practice. But most of the practice really is going to take place during our daily life.
Well, of course, because that's when we are encountered with things too. That's when the test really comes, right? When that annoying person says something, what's my reaction? You know, there's your test. Without that, it's kind of like that, what is that story about a monk that had the tea boy and he...
Oh, yes. That was Atisha. Atisha's tea boy. He kept someone around to irritate him.
Right.
Because he had heard that, this was before he went to Tibet, he'd heard that Tibetans were so nice that nobody would ever irritate him, so he wouldn't be able to do his practice. Like, that was his practice. So he took the tea boy with him, and then at the end he said, I didn't really need the tea boy.
I love that.
Yes. Okay. Anybody have any other things to share? I'm finding this a very helpful discussion.
I have something.
Is that Kathy?
This is Kathy.
Okay. Can everybody hear Kathy?
Yes.
Okay. Hello.
Yes, we hear you.
Okay. Again, I've really enjoyed Ken MacLeod's interpretation. And what the thing that he says here is that life is tough, but when you see and accept what is actually happening, even if it is very difficult or painful, mind and body relax. There is an exquisite quality that comes from just experiencing what arises completely with no separation between awareness and experience. That really hit me.
Yeah.
And I've just been thinking in the last couple days, you know, awareness and experience. It's like I never put those two together before, you know? And anyway, I just...
Yeah, thanks, Kathy. Was that it?
Yeah.
Yeah, so we're actually going to read, if we have time, which I think we do, we're actually going to read Ken MacLeod in its entirety today. I think commentary was really, really helpful.
Oh, okay. Well, I just read a piece.
No, that's good. That's good because it fit right into the discussion. That's really important. Yeah, it was good. Very apropos in the moment. Anybody have anything else? Patrick, yeah.
I'm curious about the definition of some of these things. I wonder what liberation is. And I'm also, the phrase that got me was doesn't ever change.
Mm-hmm.
You don't hear that very often. I mean, usually the teachings end up with impermanences. Well, constant change is the only constant, really.
It's the only constant in samsaric experience. That's one of the things that defines it as samsara, but nirvanic experience is unchanging. Awareness is unchanging. Space is unchanging. So there are some things that don't change. So I think that's a really great question to answer it very briefly. So that is a really good question. What are we freeing ourselves from? Anybody got an answer? What is it freedom from? I mean, don't say samsara. Like, what does that mean?
There's a definition on page 93.
Okay, you want to read it to us?
Sure. It says, liberation means freeing yourself from the ties of your emotions and negative actions.
Yeah. It's okay, so what makes us not free right now is what Pema Chodron hinted at in her commentary on verse 8. It's that we go unconscious. We act out of unconscious patterns. We can't control our body, speech, and mind. We find ourselves yelling at somebody. We find ourselves, I'm going to just mute everybody briefly because there's noise. But we can unmute when people have things to say. We're at the mercy of like whatever emotion comes up, whatever button gets pushed, like we got the reaction for it. We can't control it. We can't even see it. So we're in a constant state of turmoil. I am sorry. I have to go. I meant to say I'm expecting a delivery. Everybody can continue discussing. I'll unmute you or you can meditate, whatever. And I will be right back in a couple of minutes. Did we lose Patrick for the moment?
Yeah.
Okay, we'll answer his question when he gets back then. Anybody got anything else?
I have one comment, which is, I wonder if it's, I mean, we're suffering, so that already is pretty awful enough. If you just notice kind of three levels of suffering and all this stuff. So I wonder why it's necessary to introduce an extra thing like fear of suffering. It's kind of like just notice the suffering and then, you know, develop a motivation to, for yourself and for other beings to get free of it, you know, liberate from it.
I think the problem is when we aren't actually outright suffering, because we're not all the time. I mean, we're experiencing the third kind of suffering all the time, but we may not be aware of that. And if things are basically good, we may not be motivated to free ourselves.
I see.
So it's realizing that suffering is ahead, even if we're not having it right now, and also learning to recognize the subtle, more subtle signs that even our good experiences are suffering. And that's something we just have to look at ourselves. That's a contemplation. Yeah, Patrick.
But is that equanimity? Freedom from attachment and aversion?
Well, freedom, that's freedom would be equanimity. You know, equanimity is one quality of freedom. That's a really good observation. So it's liberation? It's what?
Is that liberation? Is that a mechanism for freedom?
Well, it is a state of freedom. Equanimity is a state of freedom. It's a state, it's what the Buddha called taming our mind. What is it that we're taming? We're taming the emotions that carry us away and cause us suffering and cause us to then engage in actions that hurt people and pile the karma on. So it's freedom from that whole chain of cause and reaction. It's freedom from the 12 links of interdependent origination. It's like if before you start a thing, you know, you start the anger or you start the, you know, addiction or you start the whatever it is, like it's just like having the phone, the thing on your phone, you know, you can catch yourself and go, everything is interdependent. If I refrain from seeing this in a dualistic way, if I refrain from solidifying this situation when my button is pushed, then it's not going to unleash the whole chain of 12 things that ends up in basically death. So I don't know if this is helping to answer your question, but some things don't change. And that is like the Dharmakaya, for example, doesn't change. That's the only level of Buddhahood that doesn't actually change. It's the formless level. We want to put ourselves in touch with that. And equanimity is the way to do it. And that's something we cultivate. You can't make yourself have equanimity, but you can work on directly on addressing your emotions as they come up, your emotional afflictions as they come up. And that's the path, is we go from not being free at all, like somebody pushes our button and we're just gone, to like complete freedom is somebody pushes our button and our mind is not disturbed by anything whatsoever, which is the definition of patience. It just doesn't bother us. That's complete freedom. Equanimity is it doesn't bother. And in between, there's this whole spectrum where we're working with it. And so we're gaining more degrees of freedom. I'll bet we all feel and have more freedom than we did before we met the Dharma. But we recognize our emotions coming. And if we fall prey to them in the moment, we have ways to deal with that, to recover, to purify, and so forth. So, Patrick, do you feel like your question got answered?
Yeah, that's pretty close. The thing that remains a little bit is about judgment.
And what is that? Because that's an important thing to...
Well, judgment about making choices, you know, something that's good for you or not walking into traffic. Mm-hmm.
Right.
Equanimity can only go so far without getting in trouble, it seems like.
No, equanimity is completely alert. It's alert and engaged. It's just not bothered. So you know, you see the cars. Equanimity is not like being spaced out, and it's not being indifferent. Equanimity has a heart. It can be filled with unbearable compassion when we see suffering. But it just means that we don't get emotionally triggered by whatever we see or whatever happens to us. But compassion is not an emotional affliction. Our compassion can get triggered. That fits in with equanimity just fine. It's that we're not disturbed. So is that helping?
Yeah, that's fine.
And we don't want to judge ourselves. Again, and you and Fanny bring this up sometimes, and maybe other people. Really important not to judge ourselves harshly. Like, we're just on the path. We're going to mess up all the time. That's the path to anything. Like, how do you get to Carnegie Hall? It's like you make a million mistakes. You hit a million wrong notes. Probably that's like a really conservative number. You put on some really bad performances and recitals. If you're bad at it, then it gets better. And eventually you're, you know, Yo-Yo Ma. Yo-Yo Ma, like, you know, he had his own path he had to follow. He didn't come out of the womb, probably, you know, being a great musician with the potential. All right, so let's go on then to, I'm going to mute everybody again. Sorry for that interruption. But it was a good thing that I caught the person. So we're going to, we have about a half hour left, and we're going to first look very briefly at Dingo Chense's book. We're mostly going to look at Ken MacLeod today and a little bit of Pema Chidren. So I just wanted to look at Dingo Chense on page 91. If you have the book, it's fine. If you don't, just how he introduces this verse, the italics that are above the actual verse. I really like these little insertions, and I don't think that they're things Dingo Chense said. I think they're probably from the Padmakara Translation Committee, and Mathieu Ricard was the main translator for this book, main translator and editor. So they added like little things like this. So second, the path for beings of medium capacity. This involves detaching yourself from samsaric pleasures and redirecting your efforts toward liberation. So in the first stage of the path, said to be for lesser beings, but it just means it's the beginning of the path, we just realize how much we're suffering and we want to put an end to it. So we've escaped the bad stuff, but now we need to escape the good stuff because we see the futility of what passes for happiness in samsara. So this is about transcending samsara completely, the good, the bad, and the ugly, as I put it in the blog. So to skip ahead to page 93, he said a couple of things I wanted us to look at together. In the middle of the page, if you recognize delusion for what it is, and okay, let's talk about delusion for a second. What is delusion? Like, why are we in samsara? You know, to go back to the very beginning of the ornament of precious liberation. What makes it samsara is that we're seeing things in a confused way. We don't see them the way they really are. One aspect of that confusion or delusion is we think we're happy. We think if we get the job, we're set. We think if this person marries us, we will be happy for the rest of our lives, happily ever after. That's the delusion. We think if we get what we want, we'll be happy. And if we avoid what we don't want, we'll be happy. As long as we're not suffering, we're happy, but it's not real happiness. So that's the delusion. So if you recognize delusion for what it is, you will see that there is nothing worthwhile in this ordinary world, nothing in the whole of samsara. And that's for everybody to think about on their own. There's a contemplation, like, is that completely true? Is that literally true? That nothing, there's nothing worthwhile in the ordinary world? What does he mean by that? We're not going to try to go into that now, but it's something to think about as we read these chapters. Like, what does it mean, nothing worthwhile? Like, think of some things that are worthwhile and then examine them from a Dharma point of view. And I don't know what conclusion you will reach, but it's worth thinking about because you don't internalize it until you take it apart. Okay, so that's about recognizing the futility of even happiness and samsara. And then at the bottom of the page, he said, beings of lesser capacity see the suffering of the lower realm. Well, let's start at the beginning of that paragraph. Realized beings, that's bodhisattvas, people who see things the way they actually are. They see the higher realms of existence, like the gods' realms, as no better than the hell realms. Beings of lesser capacity, the ones who are trying to escape suffering, see the suffering of the lower realms and wish to be reborn in the higher realms because they think that's where they'll find happiness. Beings of medium capacity, the level that we're at today, see that everything throughout samsara is unsatisfactory and ends in suffering. They see samsara as like a big house on fire within which there is nowhere to stay or nowhere safe to stay. And that's an image that's used, you know, that we should practice the Dharma as if our hair were on fire. Like if your hair was really on fire, well, first you'd be running to find some water. But if you couldn't put it out, like you'd be taking refuge. Like we'd go straight to the Dharma there, I think. Okay, and then recognizing the nature of samsara, which we just did, you will feel weary of it. We will just be sick of it. And such weariness will inspire you to strive toward liberation. And by striving for it, you will attain it. Samsara will never just disappear on its own. And again, that reflects the really chilling phrase that Gampoka includes in his, you know, the introduction to Ornament of Precious Liberation, right? Samsara will never disappear on its own. There's no end to it. You have to want to get rid of it actively yourself. And again, you know, that brings us back to how do we get rid of samsara? Well, it doesn't mean that we make samsara perfect. That's one of Lama Narla Rinpoche's favorite phrases, samsara will never come perfect. When he sees us working so hard to try to fix something in our life, samsara will never come perfect. Like just direct your attention to, as Patrick brought up, equanimity, like having equanimity and contentment in all situations. And then you fix what has to be fixed, but you don't peg your happiness to whether the outer circumstance is making you happy or not. So your mind is undisturbed. So I want to go on now to Ken McLeod. Thank you, Kathy, for mentioning how much that helped you, like his thoughts on this. And I may not be able to read the whole thing. I don't know how many people have it. How many people do not have the Ken McLeod commentary? Okay, yeah, so a few people, and that's fine. You don't have to have it. I'm going to read it today. He has a slightly different translation. So he starts by saying, the pursuit of happiness for its own sake is a fool's errand. And we do that all the time, right? The gallon of ice cream, the new job, the new relationship, the better house. As a goal, it is frivolous and unrealistic. Frivolous because happiness is a transient state dependent on many conditions, and unrealistic because life is unpredictable and pain may arise at any time. the happiness you feel when, and I love this sentence, the happiness you feel when you get something you have always wanted, let's see if we can tune into that feeling. We just got something we wanted for such a long time and we finally got it. The happiness you feel when you get something you have always wanted typically lasts no longer than 3 days. And maybe we can't relate to that, but many of us may have been in love at some point in our life. Like, how long does the feeling of being in love last? You know, you get married, like it's perfect. You're going to live happily ever after. But how long does that glow actually last before it just turns into more problems and irritation? And then you still love the person, but the glow goes away. And that's what he's talking about here, that glow of happiness. It really, you buy the thing in the store that you wanted and saved up for so long, and you get it home, and no sooner do you get it out of the bag than it's like just another thing, you know? That happens to me a lot. So he says, bliss states in meditation are similar. Whether they arise as physical or emotional bliss, or the bliss of infinite space, infinite consciousness, or infinite nothingness. These states soon dissipate once you re-engage the messiness of life. So you're sitting in meditation and just have this completely blissful experience. And you think, okay, I got it now. I finally got it. And you get up and somebody yells at you and it's like gone. Or nobody yells at you and everything is perfect for 3 days, and then it's like, oh no, it's escaping. Like, you could have the most amazing insight, and 3 days later or a week later, it's like, what was that? And you wrote it down and you read the words and it's like, nah, I don't get it now. It's like it was so real in the moment. So he says, a dewdrop on a blade of grass indeed. The quest for happiness is a continuation of the traditional view of spiritual practice. So let's think now. He's encouraging us to think now about, why do we practice? What do we think it's leading up to? What expectations do we have about how our lives are going to improve if we practice? So the quest for happiness is a continuation of the traditional view of spiritual practice, a way to transcend the vicissitudes of the human condition. Valhalla, paradise, heaven, nirvana, all hold out a promise of eternity, bliss, purity, or union with an ultimate reality. These four spiritual longings are all escapist reactions to the challenges everyone encounters in life. Like, is Sita Rinpoche's life easy? No way. He encounters like crap all day long, like difficult situations, difficult people. It didn't go away. Like, the ultimate point of this verse is it's not going to get better. Our life is not going to get better. Our circumstances are not going to get better, even if we're Sita Rinpoche or the Karmapa. The poor Karmapa, think about what his life is like, his outer circumstances. You know, even without like any questions that Patrick sometimes, you know, brings into the conversation about like how harsh their training is and how isolated they become. My God, he's like, people want him all day and all night long, all over the world. Like, the expectations of him never, ever stop. That must be such a big burden to carry. And he carries it, and he carries it gracefully. Sita Rinpoche, the Karmapa Dingo, Chense Rinpoche, they all were so, they're real bodhisattvas, but their lives were not fun. It's not a fun life. I can say that, like, as just a very low-level beginner lama. It's like, it's not fun. It's like, it doesn't make your life a wonderful thing. It's like, it's a lot of work and a lot of grief a lot of the time. So it's not going to get better. And if you don't realize that, then you really need to study the three kinds of suffering and verse 9. And we don't get it. We really don't. I don't get it, because I live my life as if it's going to get better. You know, we're going to finally, equanimity is very helpful. It just doesn't make the outer circumstances better. So it gets better in the sense that it doesn't bother us. And that's huge. And that's the thing that we can get to. Sita Rinpoche, the Karmapa, you know, Dingo Chense Rinpoche, they weren't bothered. Kala Rinpoche, there's a legend that someone once brought bad news to Kala Rinpoche about some project he had. And for a second, a look flickered over his face. Like, he had a reaction, and then it was gone, and he was perfectly, everything's perfectly like color. If you ever met Kala Rinpoche, he was like floating. He floated. He almost had no physical, you know, ties. He just was floating in this state all the time. You could just see it looking at him. But his life, like his actual life, like he had to deal with stuff all the time, constantly. So I'm digressing and using up time here, but it's very important to realize this, that when we think we're going to have nirvana or go to the God's realm, we already know, like, okay, that's not going to be better because they have their own suffering. We think we're going to be enlightened and like everything is going to then be perfect and it'll be peaceful and joyful. Well, that's an inner state that we strive for. I think it's a more like an equanimity. I don't really know. But like the actual thing itself, the samsara thing itself, we can't fix that. That is not going to get better. Our problems are not going to disappear. We're just going to deal with them in a different way and feel them in a different way. So he said, and you know, I'm jumping ahead here, obviously, take a moment and think about what you are seeking in your practice. Like, what are you practicing for? Is it a kind of transcendence? If not in God, then in a God surrogate, such as timeless awareness, that's like wisdom, the Buddha nature, pure bliss or infinite light. Are you looking for an awareness so deep and powerful that your frustration and difficulties with life vanish in the presence of your understanding and wisdom? Are you not looking for a ticket out of the messiness of life? If you think of freedom as a state, you are in effect looking for a kind of heaven. Instead, think of freedom as a way of experiencing life itself. This may be the quote that, that Kathy read. Think of freedom as a way of experiencing life itself, a continuous flow in which you meet whatever arises in your experience, you open to it, and you do what needs to be done to the best of your ability, and then you receive the result. And you do this over and over again. A freedom that never changes then becomes the constant exercise of everything you know and understand. It is the way you engage life. That's the freedom. It's not, you're not free from problems. You're free from being bothered by problems, being upset and disturbed and defeated by problems. It is the way you engage life. It is not something that sets you apart from life. You don't get out of samsara. You're still here, but you experience it differently because you're experiencing it with wisdom and compassion instead of fear and avoidance or pursuit of things that you think that you want, of fleeting happinesses. All right, I think this is what Kathy read. Life is tough, but when you see and accept what is actually happening, even if it is very difficult or painful, mind and body relax. We stop resisting. We drop our resistance. That's what relaxes us. We don't, it's not that we can get rid of the thing that's bothering us. We drop our resistance to it. And then mind and body relax. There is an exquisite quality that comes from just experiencing what arises completely, with no separation between awareness and experience. So we're practicing for that when, as Susan brought up, we're washing the dishes and we're just noticing the feeling of the water on our hands. Whatever it is, we're practicing to be able to have that same state of undisturbed awareness, just open receptiveness when somebody hits us in the face with a brick, you know, or whatever it is that's going to happen to us. Someone breaks up with us, you know, someone wrecks our car. We want to have that just same quality, just like we were washing dishes and feeling the water. We just experience the thing with complete awareness and complete compassion. That's our Buddha nature. He said, some call it joy, right, this exquisite quality. Some call it joy, but it is not a giddy or excited joy. It is deep and quiet, a joy that in some sense is always there, waiting for you, but usually touched only, I just have to check my battery. Good, okay. Usually only touched when some challenge, pain, or tragedy leaves you with no other option but to open and accept what is happening in your life. And we could look at our experience and see, like, has that ever happened? It's definitely happened to me where you hit the wall. Like, you can't change the thing, and it's just total suffering. You can't do anything about it. And if you continue to resist it, it's just pain, 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 pain. And if you just accept, okay, it's going to hurt, you can be very relaxed about it and very receptive and have equanimity about it. Always a work in progress, but you can experience it that way. So he says, others call it truth. Well, I think I'm going to like skip that paragraph. He says, in this freedom, oh, wait a minute, no, let's not skip it. It leads to a good place. Others call it truth, but this is a loaded and misleading word. Like, we're practicing the Dharma in order to experience truth. So this is a loaded and misleading word, carrying with it the notion of something that exists apart from the experience itself. Truth as a concept, so we're applying a concept to it when we call it truth, instead of just experiencing the experience. Truth as a concept sets up an opposition with what is held to be not true. And such duality necessarily leads to hierarchical authority, institutional thinking, and violence. And isn't that the world we live in right now? Like two sides in opposition, each one thinking that it's got the truth. So I think calling Dharma the truth is a little different, but it does maybe set up that same opposition, and then we could judge people who are not on the same path as us. Instead, what we want to do is be open to all experience. So he's going to, and Valerie, did you have something to say? I'll unmute you.
A better way is when they use that expression, seeing things as they are, mm-hmm. instead of saying the truth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I think that that's a very useful way to put it, to see things as they are, instead of to see, because everybody thinks they see the truth. All of us sitting here, we all think we see the truth. But it's different than somebody else's truth. And we can get into trouble, and it can lead to violence, as this said. Maybe not from any of us, but we see that. So thank you. Yes, seeing things as they are is the way that it's often put. All right. So the last paragraph here in Ken MacLeod's commentary, in this freedom, you are free from the projections of thought and feeling. So that's what freedom is, freedom from, Patrick. In this freedom, you are free from the projections of thought and feeling, and you are awake and present in your life. Reactions may still arise, but they come and go on their own. Like with Kala Rinpoche, you know, when he like had this flicker of irritation and then it was like never to be seen again. Reactions may still arise, but they come and go on their own, like snowflakes alighting on a hot stone. That is an image that's used in the Ocean of Definitive Meaning to describe a way of meditating, like to see thoughts, to let thoughts come, but then let them dissolve on their own, just like a snowflake touching a hot stone, or like mist in the morning sun, or like a thief in an empty house, just gone, no reason to be here. So if we don't, from our side, fixate on what happens to us and make projections about it, it's just experience that comes up and passes through and is gone. Everything, every single thing that happens to us is like that, even if it's a long-term thing. So he says, what is freedom? Patrick, he's just answering your question. What is freedom? It is nothing more and nothing less than life lived awake. Same old life, we're not going to get a better life, but we're just going to wake up to the essence of this life. All right, we have a few minutes left. If anybody has anything they'd like to say, they can say it. I would just like to also have a couple of minutes to read Pema Chidren's short commentary on this. Anybody have anything? John, I'm unmuting you. Okay.
Okay. Well, I've been struggling with this here phrase in the book. So
Dingo Chensei's book?
Yeah. You won't accomplish both the Dharma and the aims of this ordinary life. If that's your wish, no doubt you're deceiving yourself. And then what I'm gathering from what you've explained is that we're using Dharma rather as a tool for samsara instead of trying to accomplish something. I don't know. I'm just working it out. So
yeah. We all have to work it out for ourselves, like what it means, like what we think it means as it's explained, and what it means to us and how we can apply it to our life. And that's a process. But yeah, I think the point is, like, what brings us back to that question of, does he really mean all our efforts, to strive in all our efforts to be free? Well, we can use all of our experience to do that. So what Dingo Chensi Rinpoche is saying there, and a lot of teachers have said that, great teachers like Milarepa and Gampopa, you can't, and Kali Rinpoche, you can't mix Dharmic aspirations with worldly aspirations. They don't go together and you'll just get stuck in worldly aspirations. It doesn't mean that you can't build an addition onto your house, you know, or buy a new car or study anthropology. I mean, you could do those things, but they are, like, especially studying anthropology, I mean, that would be like a distraction because that's going to take all of your attention. But that may be what you need to do, like to have a career. You can use that, like, you can always apply awareness to that. Always be working on your emotions, like on taming your emotions through that, like not reacting to people through that. Any experience can be used as a tool, as you said, to actually progress on the Dharma path, the path of Dharma. Our entire life can be Dharma practice, even as we accomplish things we have to accomplish. What he's talking about there is the motivation. Like actually investing yourself in the worldly thing and thinking it's going to bring you happiness, that it's really meaningful and important. If we bear in mind that it's just what we have to do right now, but it's not the ultimate thing that we're working on, then I think we can live up to this instruction.
Yeah, I see it. I see that. Thank you.
Okay, great question. Anybody have anything else? Then we will finish off with Pema Chodron. She calls this verse impermanence. So it's, the previous one was called karma, and this one she calls impermanence, but it's also the suffering of samsara. It's presented in both of those ways. And as you know, in Gampopa, in the Ornament of Precious Liberation, there's a chapter on each one, but they're covering the same bases. Everything you find in Gampopa, you can find in the 37 practices and vice versa, as we've seen a number of times. So this covers two full chapters in Gampopa, impermanence and the suffering of samsara. So Pema Chodron says, this is my favorite verse. Too bad I don't have much time left. She did that before. There was one verse, she did, a spiritual teacher, she only gave a sentence to it because she had used up all her time. It's my favorite verse, too bad not much time. So let's think about, like, having a favorite verse. That might be something to talk about. I'd like to talk sometime about, like, we've done now 9 verses. Like, are there any that resonate more than others? I don't think we'll get to that today, but that'd be an interesting thing to talk about. Anyway, she says, I'll leave you with this. The highest level of freedom is one that never changes, like open space, like the pause, like the gap. You know, in the midst of thoughts, we have a pause or a gap, and it's just there. Like, it's always the same gap. If you look at it, it's always the same gap. It's always the same pause. It's always the same connection with open awareness. Those things don't change, and that's where we find our freedom. So she says, strangely enough, we experience that as groundless. And that's a word that Trungpa Rinpoche used a lot. Groundless, emptiness, groundless. Let's just think about when we're having an experience that feels groundless, how does that feel? Does that feel good? I think it doesn't. Like, we encounter something that we don't know how to deal with. We're in a state where we don't know what's going to happen. We don't know what we should do. All the people in Houston and Louisiana who have lost their homes, they're in shelters. And I've heard, I haven't seen a lot of the coverage, they don't have TV, but I've seen some clips and people are like, I don't know what I'm supposed to do. Like, I'm just here in this shelter. I don't know about my house. I don't know what I'm supposed to do. That's groundlessness. And we all experience that throughout the day at various times. So she said, strangely enough, this freedom, this awareness, this openness, we experience that as groundless, which is not a good feeling to us. And she's going to explain why. She said, that which never changes, the highest level of freedom, to the degree that we need something to hold on to, that we always need ground under our feet, that we are threatened by uncertainty and unpredictability, that we are threatened by paradox and lack of definition. To the degree that we resist that feeling of groundlessness and dig in our heels and become more polarized and prejudiced, that which never changes to that degree is experienced as groundless and scary and very unpleasant. We feel we need to seek resolution. And I know for myself, I want things to resolve. I do not like that feeling of don't know what to do, don't know what's going to happen, don't know where to go, don't know where I am. Being lost on a highway, you know, in Arkansas, you don't know, like, where am I? We need resolution. And so that's resisting this thing that never changes, which is always there. She says, so what do we do? Like, how do we, like, make up that difference? She says, as we become able to hold unpleasant in our open, compassionate awareness, we begin to become familiar with the highest level of freedom, that which never changes. So this is really brilliant. It's like, what is our reaction? And this is how we know how stuck we are in samsara. Something bad happens. Let's just say it's an unpleasant smell or the sound of somebody with a chainsaw right outside our window. What is our first reaction? It's like, get me out of here. Like, stop that noise. Gotta go in another room. Get away from that smell. Get away from this situation that's making me irritable. But we try to get rid of the situation. We try to fix the situation. That's not being open to all experience. And I don't mean we should never correct things that we can correct, but just to see in our minds that that's our reflex reaction is fix it, get out of it. So she's suggesting that we, when we encounter something unpleasant that is not life-threatening and not something that we need to fix, like somebody attacking another person, but it's just an unpleasant thing, what if we just didn't try to get away from it? What if we increased our capacity for holding that, for being with that in a state of equanimity? Like, we became okay with that, or we practiced being okay with that. So she says, there's just one thing, being able to hold the whole quality of human experience from best to worst. It feels really good to, it feels really bad. Being able to hold that, to come to know that, to be able to hold and embrace that, to be able to relax with that, the full spectrum of experience. When we can do that, we are simultaneously connecting with the highest freedom. And that, thank you for the word, Patrick, equanimity is what that is. So she ends by saying, this is a pep talk. It's worth hanging out with a little uneasiness every day of your life. So next time you feel anxious or something unpleasant is happening, maybe just give yourself a minute. You could pull out your phone and look at the Buddha, remember the refuges, but stay with it and, like, see if you can open your heart to it and not try to get away. And that is the point of this verse, that we're going for that state of mind. It's not freedom from adversity. It's freedom from needing to get away from adversity. It's like having the capacity to be there with anything in a state of awareness and compassion. And that's it. And we've run a minute over. My apologies. Anybody got anything that they need to say before we do our prayers? Let me find my prayers. I did have one question. Just if people could give me feedback, you can do this since we're over time, maybe just do it by email. But are we good with week after week, or do we need a break at any point? And that's a perfectly valid thing. If people feel like they need a week or two at some point to sort of regroup and let things sink in, I'm good with that. And otherwise, until we hit something where maybe I have to take a break, we can just keep going. But I would like feedback on that if you have any. If nobody has feedback on that, I'll assume we're good and we just keep going week to week. Valerie, I'm going to unmute you.
Yes. I'm good. Okay. I don't need a break.
Okay. All right. But if anybody does feel like that, they can let me know. All right. So we're going to do our dedication of merit. making this a complete complete session of study, contemplation, and meditation within the Buddhist and the Vajrayana tradition. This merit may it win omniscience, defeat my faults the enemy, then from the rough and stormy sea of birth, old age, death, and disease, from this ocean of samsara, may I liberate all beings. They know things in their true existence, Kuntu, Sampo, and Manjushri. To train myself in their example, I dedicate this practice fully. May every being through this practice completely gather merit and wisdom, attaining the two sacred bodies that merit and wisdom emanate, the blessings of the Buddha Kayas, the blessings of changeless Dharmata, the blessings of the steadfast Sangha. This dedication please fulfill. And we will just let our minds come to rest, connecting with that open awareness that is ultimate bodhicitta, and also with that love and compassion, which is relative bodhicitta. In a state of equanimity, which is being neither too alert or agitated, nor too relaxed or sleepy and dull. All right, and I will unmute everybody, and that's it for today.